Leaders are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire, to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, David Brown, managing editor and host of the statewide daily news magazine, Texas Standard. Hosting the conversation is Maxie Parrish, journalism professor at Baylor University and member of KWBU's Board of Directors. This conversation was recorded October 20th, 2016, in the KWBU studio.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Maxie Parrish, a board member here at KWBU, talking with David Brown, host and managing editor of the statewide daily news magazine show, Texas Standard. David, I want to first to ask you, you have a very interesting academic background. I'm a professor here at Baylor in the journalism department, and I'm seeing a law degree, a master's degree in classic great books, a bachelor's degree in journalism, but you're also doing a PhD currently at the University of Texas. Are you the ultimate Renaissance man?
No, I am not. I'm definitely not that. But I'll tell you, I fell in love with education at an odd place. It was sort of odd how this came about. As a student, you know, when I was in high school, I was blessed enough to have a family committed to education. My parents were educators, and they sent me to a wonderful private school. But it was also something where I never really wanted to apply myself, and I wasn't really interested in school.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of folks can. But what happened was I was at a particular point in my life. I guess this would have been in the early 90s. When a lot of things were just kind of blowing up around me. And I was living in Annapolis, Maryland at the time. And I had my bachelor's degree, and I just sort of scraped by. I went to a perfectly good state school. I just wanted to get the regent's signatures on a piece of paper, you know, so that I could get a good job. But in Annapolis, someone introduced me to the college in town, there's a Naval Academy. And there was also St. John's College, which had a really unique background. And I didn't know much about it. I was pretty much resigned to not doing it. But someone said, you really need to sort of expand a little bit, expand your horizons. Mm-hmm. And so I went and checked it out. Someone gave me a little guided tour. I sat through a class, and it was really intriguing. By the time I signed up for St. John's.
And what was that class?
Well, it was the way that they do classes at St. John's. They do it by the old Oxford system. Mm. So you're reading through a series of what are considered to be the great books of Western civilization. Mm-hmm. So you're studying, but you're actually just reading. Mm-hmm. And you're reading Socrates, and you're reading some of the more modern pieces are actual Supreme Court decisions.
Wow.
So it's not necessarily just the great books per se, mm-hmm. but they're influential works. Mm-hmm. And you'd have seminars and preceptorials. But what I loved about it was that we would all sit around a table. None of us, I wasn't David, I was Mr. Brown. And everyone was Mr. or Ms. whatever. We'd sit around a table and talk about what we read. And it wasn't that it was easy. It was that I would see things based on how others had experienced these readings that I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. And it got to a point where by the end of this master's program, I was feeling lost. I was like, now what? Now what do I do? Mm-hmm. And one of my tutors, they're not professors, they're tutors, mm-hmm. He said, you really need to look into law school. Mm. And so I did. But I didn't care about formal education until that point. So mm-hmm. I'm eternally grateful to St. John's and to the program, mm-hmm. really, that mm-hmm. For what it did. It just...
Did you ever think about practicing law?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing about law school. Law is so interesting to me, but the practice of law means assembling facts. Mm-hmm. And I like this. I like the idea of playing with the ideas of the law more than I like actually getting ready for trial. Mm. So I did have a part-time practice when I was living in California, And I did work for some other law firms. I did, in fact, when I was in law school, I did AmeriCorps work, where I was a poverty mm-hmm. lawyer, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that amounted to being a social worker. But it's interesting, when I was doing this as an AmeriCorps attorney, I made a really interesting discovery. I was working at a what amounted to you were basically helping people who didn't have any money mm-hmm. get through basic experiences. Mm-hmm. And I made a couple of discoveries. One was that the people that we were serving pro bono, mm-hmm. they were the people that you'd see every day at the Kmart behind the cash register. They mm-hmm. were the people you'd see at the drive-through window, right? Mm-hmm. So my ideas about poverty completely changed. These were people in our community.
The working poor.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. And another thing that just blew my mind, once I was working with someone who had gotten ripped off by a car dealer, and I'd done basically a threatening letter, and we sent it off, and she was able to get out of the deal. Wonderful ending. So I'm copying some letters there in the law office, mm-hmm. and she says, "Mr. Brown, may I ask you a question?" "Sure." "Do you have to have a high school diploma to be a lawyer?" And I realized that the chasm between her experience and mine was so great
yeah.
that most people don't have any idea what so many in our population are actually experiencing. There's such a huge divide.
A disconnect.
Disconnect is the word, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that more than anything else, what the law degree has done is it's given me just other opportunities to kind of learn, I guess.
Sure. And tell me about your doctoral work. What do you do in your PhD?
Well, this is an extension, I guess, just primarily of just exploring. But at University of Texas, they have a fellow there who is one of the leading theorists in journalism. His name is Maxwell McCombs, and he developed a theory that's called, now I'm blanking out, and here we are doing live radio. but essentially, the theory suggests that media, agenda-setting theory, of course.
Sure.
The agenda-setting theory basically says that the mass media sort of dictates not how we think about something, but maybe what we think about.
Sure.
You see something on television and people begin to talk about it and the conversations go from there. Well, this was really an important theory during the mass media era. But these days, well, what does it mean in the digital era? Well, you don't have conglomerates that are kind of dictating to us. You don't have Walter Cronkite, you know,
exactly.
delivering the news. So does the agenda setting theory actually hold water in this new, whatever we want to call this era, this digital era? Mm-hmm. And that's basically, in a nutshell, the heart of what I'm working on my dissertation.
How close are you to finishing?
Okay. I can't go there.
don't ask.
I'm done with my coursework, and in fact, I was just going back and forth with the advisor this morning on my telephone. I've already had my program approved, and so here we go.
Yeah, it's interesting that you are formalizing your learning. You know, a lot of people are lifelong learners, but you're staying with it in a very formal sense. So this keeps you very busy, obviously, but what do you like to read when you've got the time?
Biographies. I unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of patience for fiction. I should, mm-hmm. but I love biographies, and I really love history. The whole series that Robert Caro did on LBJ is one of my favorites of all time.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The Churchill books, the autobiographies, and his books on the Great Wars were, mm-hmm. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I like to read.
Do you ever find yourself reading a biography and thinking to yourself, I'd like to be like that?
I guess we probably all do, so on some level,
sure.
But, more than that, I think I like to see the way that today echoes history. Mm-hmm. I mean, history doesn't repeat itself. It just sort of rhymes, you know. Mm-hmm. And I like to see those patterns because you probably know this. We have this idea that whatever it is that we're experiencing right now, it's the first time it's ever happened.
Right.
And the younger you are, the more inclined you are to think that way.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But we've been there. very essence of who we are hasn't really changed that much. We're not that much more wise than our grandparents were.
Right.
Now, we may have more information, but sometimes I doubt our capacity to deal with it.
Yeah. I was reading something last night in The Atlantic that said that the roots of Israel and Palestine go back to the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. You know, how are you going to fix something that's been around for that long?
I have faith that something like that is fixable. But the reason I have faith is because other things that we felt were intractable have been fixed, right?
Sure, yes.
So maybe few quite that old, but but nonetheless, you got to have faith.
I agree. You have an affinity for music, rock music.
I love it.
Okay.
Pretty much all music. I won't lie to you.
Okay. Before we go there, for those of you who are just now joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Maxie Parrish, talking today with David Brown, host and managing editor of the statewide daily news magazine show, Texas Standard. And you were about to talk about music.
Oh, I love it. It's funny because Texans in general, I think it's storytelling more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about there's got to be a reason why people like Guy Clark and Towns Van Zandt and Willie Nelson. What is the thing between these characters and Texas? And I think in a way, Texas has such a strong oral storytelling tradition that in a sense, its music has become a way of propagating that. I love it. It's rock music, but I like Americana music and love the blues. It's fun. I wish I were a better musician myself. But
what do you play?
Anything to get my hands on, but not well. I love guitar, and I used to play in a rock band back when I was growing up. And in fact, I sort of stumbled into radio because of rock and roll in a sense.
Okay.
Can I tell this?
Please do.
So what happened was I was playing in a rock band when I was, after high school, and I didn't know really what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. The expectation from my parents was I would go to college, but I really didn't want to. And I was playing a rock band. We were playing the Chitlin' Circuit, which basically was South Carolina, Florida, Georgia, coast, Alabama. And my dad told me that I could not continue to live at home unless I got a real job.
Oh.
And I was a little offended. I thought my job as a musician was a real job, but he didn't seem to think so. So he told me that I would have to put out my resume. And so what I did was I put my resume out to everywhere I figured I wouldn't get a gig. Mm-hmm. So I sent my resumes to a bunch of radio stations. I had no way I was going to get a gig at a radio station. Mm-hmm. Well, so one day my dad and I, we were driving down 1941, immortalized by the Allman Brothers and their song, and driving down Highway 1941, and my dad said, "So how's that job search going?" And I said, "Well, I did hear back from one radio station." And he goes, "You did? We set up an interview?" "No, I'm not going to be able to get that job. I know better." And so he pulls the car over. "Get out. Get out." So I get out of the car, and he gets out of his side, and he pins me up against the fender, and he said, "Son, you're going to get that job." This wasn't an option. Not like you're going to go try to get that job. You're going to get that job.
Okay.
So I did get the job, and it was at a little small 2,500-watt radio station in a tiny little town. Mm-hmm. The station was in the tallest building in town, a three-story structure. And I was spinning records. And on Sunday, the preachers would come in, "Read on, daughter." Mm-hmm. And, his daughter would read a passage from the Bible, and he'd have his entourage, of suit-wearing guys. And they'd pray over me and for me as I ran the microphones. And one day, there was a big storm, and I could see it out the window. I could see the little blinking transmitter, the distance, the aerial for the station. Mm-hmm. And I get goosebumps when I tell this story, but this storm was coming. Mm-hmm. And as the skies got blacker outside, I heard in the back the AP machine, the Associated Press machine, started to shake. And the bell was ringing. Mm-hmm. Went back, ripped off whatever it was on there, and it was a weather report. And it went something like, this is a bulletin from the National Weather Service in Atlanta. So I decided I'd do what I'd seen them do in the movies. And I went to the console, and I turned off the record player, which had a Linda Ronstadt record on. Mm-hmm. Said, we interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special report from the National Weather Service. Hartsfield International Airport reporting there is a tornado that has been sighted 5 miles south-southwest of mm-hmm. McDonough, Georgia. And so I'm going on like this. And as I'm talking, for the first time it struck me that anyone listening to me, this could actually save their lives. Mm. This could actually have an effect. Mm-hmm. I didn't really ever want to do that. That was nothing that ever appealed to me about, I mean, the idea of delivering information that might actually affect someone's life. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, I thought, whoa, this is great. So the very next Monday, I went out and started putting out my resume for real at radio stations and landed myself a job at a commercial radio station doing news. And this was prior to the deregulation of the radio business.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh.
Yeah, that's how I got into radio, really.
Wow. Before we leave music, I've got to ask you, what are your thoughts on Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize?
I will say that certainly if poets deserve prizes like the Nobel, that Dylan is certainly worthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's happening with the Nobel is something I think might be worth reflection. There have been some winners that I think a lot of eyebrows have been raised. Now, in my opinion, Blood on the Tracks was the last great Dylan album mm-hmm. to me. Now, mm-hmm. he's done some just fine albums.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
He continues to be an important artist. But the point at which he was actually changing things, mm-hmm. you know, where he was doing Nobel quality of work,
yeah.
I would say Blood on the Tracks was the last mm-hmm. Really earth-shaking piece mm-hmm. that he did. So it's wonderful that he's being honored. Who could say that's a bad thing?
Yeah.
But at the same time, the fact that he has made himself unavailable to the Nobel Committee
yeah.
to accept the award, I think says something. I think he doesn't want to say, I'm not worthy of this, or nothing that I've done recently is, mm-hmm. I don't know. Who knows why he's always been enigmatic. So I'm kind of torn on this, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I can understand. I think.
What do you think about it?
Well, I've got mixed feelings. He is a great poet. But it's poetry meant to be performed with music, and they've never gone that way before. So they're breaking new ground. Do they want to do that? I suppose it's an art form worthy of consideration. But I'm like you. It is kind of a nod to the past, so to speak, a nod to his influence as opposed to what's going on now, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of an Al Gore winning it. It was because of what he was doing, you know, very recently. So I think
right.
that's an interesting concept. So you've been a lot of places. You've traveled, mm-hmm. been around the world. Do you have a favorite place?
I have to tell you, I'm humbled by this question for this reason, because in a lot when I've gone and visited radio stations, and I'm mm-hmm. here to as part of a celebration of KWBU. Let me just cut to the chase. I'm so impressed by the many people that I met here in Waco who have had mm. such incredible, they've visited everywhere and they've lived in all these wonderful exotic places and they still call Waco home. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess my favorite place, and this sounds cornball, it's Texas.
Wow. Okay. And I want to talk more about that, but first, for those of you who are just now joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Maxie Parrish, talking today with David Brown, host and managing editor of the statewide daily news magazine show, Texas Standard. So what is it
I'll tell you,
about
I'm,
Texas?
First,
are you a naturalized citizen? Have you?
I'm a naturalized citizen.
Okay,
that's the way to put it.
Okay, good.
I have my passport and the whole deal.
Good deal.
My dad turned me on to Texas. I grew up in Georgia.
Right.
And my dad turned me on to Texas when I was about 7 years old. And he would tell me stories about when he was growing up. It was during the Depression. And he would have to unscrew the light bulb to plug in the radio. That was their only mm-hmm. source of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And his father, my grandfather, whom I never knew, would they would tune in the border blasters from Del Rio.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they would get to hear music that you wouldn't get to hear on WSB or WSM coming out of Nashville, Tennessee in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You would these Clear Channel stations before Clear Channel was a brand. They would get to hear Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys.
You bet.
So that sounded interesting, and my dad pulls out a 78 with a Columbia label on it, mm-hmm. and he plays the new San Antonio Rose, not to be confused with the old one. And it blew my mind. This was rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really was. You got mm-hmm. a guy going, aha! Mm-hmm. That's, mm-hmm. man, that's party music.
Yeah, and if Texas you look, swing.
Yeah, Texas swing. There has never been a kind of amalgam of music like Texas swing. That is just, you're jamming together jazz and mm-hmm. and the blues and mm-hmm. popular music in a way that just nobody was doing that kind of stuff. So I fell in love with that idea and the notion of radio and the notion of this guy chewing on a cigar and playing the fiddle like a wild man, you know, taking, that was just so freaking romantic to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, wonder, it just sounded like another world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at the time when I was growing up, there were bands like ZZ Top and stuff like that.
Sure.
And I'd spend hours just listening to Fandango, just end over end and staring at the pictures. And I remember there's a gatefold of the old Tres Hombres album. And it was plate of Mexican
yes.
food.
Yes, yeah, I remember it well.
You remember that?
Of
and
course.
I would just sit there staring at it, listening to the music and trying to imagine what that food tasted like.
Because mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
didn't get that in Georgia. You know, you couldn't get that. So
they had pulled pork, for heaven's
sake.
Exactly,
pulled pork.
They don't even cook brisket.
That's right. So, you know, Texas for me was always this kind of thing out there.
Yeah.
It was like... When I was a kid, I always wanted to get there.
Yeah.
But I never actually set foot in Texas until the sesquicentennial, which would have been in 1986.
86, yeah.
I got the assignment of a lifetime, in a sense that I was working for the Christian Science Monitor, their broadcast service,
mm-hmm.
and they sent me out to just basically tour the state for a month.
Yeah.
So I got this unlimited pass or something on Southwest. I'd never been on an airline where you could sit backwards before and kick your feet up across
yeah.
the... Man, that was a trip.
Yeah.
And you know, got to visit rattlesnake roundups and all of this. So mm-hmm. I was really mm-hmm. digging it. Now that I get to live here, it's dream come true.
Yeah.
Sounds like malarkey to some people, but my family knows it different.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Let's talk about journalism here and the state of journalism in America today. And I'm going to quote something from the show's website. It says that your radio show is grounded in the best traditions of American journalism, fact-based, independent, and politically neutral reporting in an era in which news outlets, politics, and citizens are increasingly polarized. Texas Standard offers critical breadth, variety, and integrity. It almost reads as if you're trying to make a counterpoint to the point that is slammed in our faces so much today. Can you tell us where you see American journalism and what you're trying to do in that field?
I'm worried about American journalism.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but I take this really kind of seriously. I feel like something has happened, and I don't know if it's generational. I tend to say no, because I don't believe in the idea of the old man saying, this is how we used to do it, you know?
Sure.
But I think that something that happened during the age of mass media, when we had the three, you know, the Cronkites and the
Huntley Brinkley. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that created a kind of national consensus about what we could talk about, what was important to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that so many viewpoints never got considered.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so I'm not nostalgic for the old way that it was done. But I do think that it did something important. It served a particular purpose. And that was it kind of held the centrifugal forces of our society together.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, as a culture that... American culture sort of celebrates exploration, and so we're always reaching up for the stars, and we're always going to the moon, you know. But what may be more important or at least as important, I'll say this, mm-hmm. was that 600 million people were sharing an experience
right.
On that July 20th, 1969.
Right.
And so I think what this means, we don't have those kind of shared experiences anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you want to understand sort of how we could end up with a presidential contest that's as kooky as it is, it's because we're not really talking with each other. We're talking kind of, we're shouting at each other.
Right.
Right. I think that the problem right now with journalism is as newspapers have been tested and challenged, as their economies have been we've seen bankruptcies of some leading newspapers across mm-hmm. the country. Mm-hmm. I think what's happening is some of the folks behind the scenes think that the way to for journalism to continue in the United States is to emulate mm-hmm. social media.
Yes.
I think that's wrong.
Okay.
I think that, yes, it's okay to acknowledge that we all have our personal biases. We all have our personal histories that inform who we are. But at the end of the day, I think that it's the role of the journalist mm-hmm. to fight those mm-hmm. and to approach news without an agenda, but instead to be amplifiers for genuine conversations and to provide a forum for those conversations.
Mm-hmm. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist and PBS commentator, was here in Waco recently, mm-hmm. and he described the current presidential election as one in which the standards of civility have gone by the wayside, and he sees that as perhaps the most disturbing thing about the trend, which you described very well. We've just got a couple of minutes left, so I want to ask you, you love Texas,
mm.
okay? Where's the best barbecue in Texas?
Oh boy, that's a trick question right there. I don't know that I'm qualified to say. I wish I could say with some degree of authority.
Okay, okay.
I mean the punt. You always punt with Franklin's, but I'll tell you who does know.
Okay,
I'll tell you who does know. It's the guy who's the barbecue editor of Texas Monthly. He'll be able to tell you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna let you off on the hook with that one.
Okay.
Okay. But I've got a couple of more. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Best live music venue in Texas.
Boy, again, Texas is so big. It's where do you begin? I think Green Hall mm-hmm. would give a lot of other venues a run for the money. We'd call it best. I don't know. I'm careful. Green Hall would be a
fair
contender.
Enough. New Braunfels, yeah. The most beautiful place in Texas. Now this one's easy because this is totally subjective.
West Texas. I think the Marfa, mm-hmm. Fort Davis, Alpine Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Something just sings to me about it. But then again, you know, San Antonio doesn't on certain days. Yeah. So, yeah.
One person who best depicts Texas.
Boy, you've really got me stumped here. One person.
Yeah.
I don't think that it can be boiled down to one person because that's what makes Texas beautiful.
Okay. Okay, we've got 1 minute left. Give me your definition of Texas.
Texas is home.
Home, yeah.
That's it. That's
as good as you can get.
It's a place
where the heart feels good, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Texas is home. And the great thing about it is you don't have to be a Texan to recognize it.
Yeah.
And who knows? You might wind up here and
just like you.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of us were lucky enough to have been born here, but we welcome those who come and embrace it.
That's right. When you wish upon a star.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much. This has been a pleasure.
This has been a real pleasure to you get a chance. You've got some great questions.
Well,
thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a real honor.
But we appreciate you coming to Waco. We appreciate you coming to KWBU. And hats off to good journalism. I preach it every day in class, but I don't see it on the air very much. So thank you so much for what you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the program. I really do appreciate it. It's an honor.
This conversation was recorded October 20th, 2016 in the KWBU studio. This and past episodes of the Central Texas Leadership Series can be found on our website at kwbu.org.